Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow, to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts. It's on.
Hi, everyone. From New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is On with Kara Swisher, and I'm Kara Swisher. My guest today is Geraldine de Ruyter, the James Beard Award-winning food writer and author of two books, including her latest, If You Can't Take the Heat, Tales of Food, Feminism, and Fury. Before books, Geraldine was, like me, active in the blogosphere. She started the Everywhereist blog in 2009 and rose to prominence in 2018 for her biting takedown of chef Mario Batali. A few years later, an equal parts brutal and hilarious review of the worst meal she ever had at a Michelin-starred restaurant got so much traffic it crashed her server. The restaurant was called Bros, and one course involved sucking foam from a plaster mouth. So there's that. It's no wonder Geraldine calls herself the, quote, Gloria Steinem of culinary blogging. Half in jest, of course, but I wanted to talk to her about some of those moments and the systemic misogyny that exists in both the culinary world and online. I also want to get to a topic that's been in the news a lot recently, our relationship with food and dieting and our bodies, and the impact that weight loss drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic could have on all that. Our question today comes from Blair Braverman, celebrity dog musher, and also a great feminist writer. We'll have all that and more after the break. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. People say perfect is the enemy of good, but simple is everyone's best friend, because when something is simple and easy, it tends to work out for the best, and NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for your business. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/on, netsuite.com/on, netsuite.com/on. Support for On with Kara Swisher comes from NerdWallet. You don't have to be a genius to start making better financial decisions today. It's not that sexy, but piling up lots of little monetary victories today can yield some pretty significant rewards down the line. The tricky part is knowing where to start. NerdWallet can help. Their financial experts have helped countless people find new ways to maximize every dollar they earn. Now the team is helping folks get more from every dollar they spend. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credits side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering up to 10 times the points on every dollar you charge. Their expert team of nerds did the work reviewing top credit cards so you can trust that you have the smartest one for future you. If I had better rewards right now, I would probably travel to Hawaii and be sitting on a beach and not talking into this microphone right now. I would be enjoying a Mai Tai, possibly swimming. Doubtful I would would be surfing, but I would spend them all there. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a Smarter Travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message is brought to you by E-Trade from Morgan Stanley. Take control of your financial future with E-Trade. No matter what kind of investor you are, our tools and resources can help you be ready for what's next. Now, when you open an account, you can get up to $1,000 with a qualifying deposit. Terms apply. Learn more at etrade.com/Vox. Investing involves risks. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC. E-Trade is a business of Morgan Stanley.
Hey, Geraldine, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I am a huge fan, and my family's a big fan, and you make me laugh more than anybody.
Oh my gosh. Thanks. That's high praise.
So I just wrote a book called Burn Book, and you just wrote one called If You Can't Take the Heat. We should have coordinated on tour dates.
No kidding.
Let's talk about that idea of what the idea of can't take the heat. Mine is the same thing. It's about, you know, just taking things down. And I think you do in a different way because the subtitle of yours is Tales of Food, Feminism, and Fury. Mine is a tech love story. So talk about how you decided to call this. Obviously, it's a kitchen reference, mm-hmm. but talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that, you know, besides just the kind of obvious metaphor there, I think that there is all of this pressure and, you know, frankly, bullshit that we deal with as women. And when I started looking at the culinary industry and our relationship with food, that seemed to heighten all of it. It seemed like all of the crap that women deal with in microcosm. And I was right. like, this is it. This is perfect.
That food's the metaphor. I think I use tech as the metaphor in a very, not only about feminist issues, but other things, power, about power and how we use power in the world. And obviously, food is power. When you think about the idea of heat and fury, I like that you use the word fury. What mm-hmm. does that mean? Because, you know, of course, people like to say women have rage or you're angry and you've been subject to that. How do you look at that, the idea of what fury is to you?
I mean, I feel like it's a very targeted, focused, and I like to think of it as intentional, you know? If you think about fury, it's something that is targeted and willful, and I hesitate to say righteous.
Yeah, but why not?
Yeah, why not?
So you want to say righteous, so that it's
righteous. Sure, yeah, hell yeah, let's do it. Let's say righteous.
Why is that a loaded word? Do you think it's because it's used self-righteous women, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, and also because I've been so criticized about my anger, right? You know, I'm sure you have as well, because you are a woman in a body in the world.
Right.
And the one thing we're not allowed to do, right, repeatedly, is to get angry. We can do literally anything else, but we cannot get angry, because the second we do, we are unhinged, we're bitchy, we're irrational, we're loud, we're not to be taken seriously. We're getting overly emotional. We're premenstrual. We're postmenopausal. We're premenopausal. We're everything, right?
Yeah. I recall the expression on the rag. Remember, are you on the
rag? Oh, yeah. Yep. I know that one well. We're criticized the second we raise our voices. You know, we're accused of being shrill. It's a litany of things. And so you have to tamp it down and you really have to deny yourself your own anger. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I hesitate to even use the phrase that is in the subtitle of my book. Especially in the wake of, you know, the New York Times referring to me as loud and irrational.
Yes, we'll get to that in a second because you know, you are loud and irrational.
I am.
But let's go right to Mario Batali then. I've got other questions about your influences and inspirations, but one of the essays, the most famous, is your first post to really go viral, and this was in 2018. Mm-hmm. Everybody read this. It was your essay about celebrity chef and restaurateur Mario Batali. Mm-hmm. Two parts of the story, what you wrote about Batali in the food industry and what happened to you as a result. For people don't remember, explain the Batali Me Too backstory and what you wrote and how you did it.
Sure. So I think it was late 2017, allegations of sexual misconduct, which is, you know, later came out to be the understatement of the year, came out against Mario Batali, and we were kind of in the height of the Me Too movement. And he sent out sort of preemptively, it was the very sort of stripped down PR message that the legal team had sanitized that was, I apologize for my behavior.
Right.
It went out with his newsletter, and at the end of it included a recipe for cinnamon rolls.
Right.
It was atrocious. And everybody responded, and they were like, what the hell are you doing? But I decided to make the cinnamon rolls. And I
what
wrote
else would one do in the face of sexual harassment?
Right. Yeah, you sit, you're like, okay, let's do that. And, you know, it's a crap recipe. And I could tell by reading it that it was a crap recipe.
You could tell by reading it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a cook like you are. My son is a cook. My brother is a great cook.
Yeah.
My mom's a great cook. What could you tell?
So I do a lot of baking, right? And for one thing, it's a pizza dough cinnamon roll. And anyone who's kind of familiar with doughs at all knows that pizza dough's properties are entirely different from cinnamon roll dough property. So one is more a brioche dough. It's very soft and light. And the other one is thicker and chewier. So pizza dough, you know, you're used to having like have
sure.
to chew. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I could tell by looking at it. And that sort of became a metaphor for realizing your instincts, you know, trusting them, and then sort of being gaslit constantly and being told, no, what you see and what you perceive is not actually true.
Yeah, using food as a metaphor. Right?
Using food as a metaphor. And I wrote about all of these bullshit experiences that I personally had had or had seen, you know, in sort of the broader news, and did that as I was making the recipe.
Right.
Obviously, you can't predict virality.
Right.
But it went, I believe the technical word, and you could confirm this, is bonkers viral.
It did. Bonkers viral is the technical word.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for confirming that. Yeah. So the site crashed due to the sheer volume. Pete Wells from the New York Times was retweeting it. Martha Stewart was sharing it.
I think what was important is you used the recipe as a stunt. It's a stunt, but it was a fantastic stunt. Sometimes stunt writing works beautifully. You're going to take his advice and try the cinnamon rolls and show what a scam this is. What a scam this piece of food is. This is a bad piece of food that you're getting recommended from a guy who behaved badly. Food writers, as you said, love the essay. You ended up winning the James Beard Award for it, but you started to deal with harassment, even death threats on social media, and you engaged with the haters. Talk about that, because first everyone was like, what an essay, right? What an essay.
Right. Right. So shortly afterward, my Twitter account got hacked, and I managed to get it back, but it was through contacts that I was able to get it back so quickly. But there was a slew of hate mail, people who were like, no, these rolls look fantastic. You just don't know how to cook. You don't know what you're talking about.
So they were insulting your cooking methods.
Okay. I mean, the whole gamut of things, you know, the same thing. I'm loud, irrational, and hysterical. And that went on for a long time. And, you know, the one thing that you shouldn't do is engage. And so I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to engage. And you see this a lot, right? I think Sarah Silverman did it. Patton Oswalt did it. And they usually do it to some sort of beautiful success, right? They have some sort of understanding and everybody realizes that they're people and it's gorgeous. And I was like, I'm going to have a moment like that. I did not have a moment like that.
Right. You got some supportive comments, correct? But the vitriol is what you're talking, especially in women.
Yeah, it was, I think, once the harassers and the abusers realized that they had someone live on the line who was listening, they doubled down. So it was shocking. It was honestly shocking.
What was shocking about it? Tell me what.
I mean,
I do not try to engage with many of these people.
Nor should you. You know, so first of all, the fire hose of just absolute spewing hate at me for making a recipe, right, was probably the first layer of it. But beyond that, one of the questions that I asked all of them, and I selected people who were very clearly, you know, they were using the C word. They were, one guy told a woman to shove cheese up one of her, or, you know, a part of her anatomy. It was clear. So I asked them directly, do you think you're being abusive? And without fail, they said no.
Oh.
And I was like, how?
Yeah.
How is this possible?
Right.
And every single—
Because I am not going to shove cheese up my vagina, but go ahead.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. And the absolute disconnect and the number of them who said, I am the victim here, and you're harassing me by asking me these questions.
Huh.
And then they said the same number of arguments. Some of them were like, well, it's just the internet. And I have the freedom to say whatever I want. And you put yourself out there in the first place. And if you don't want to hear it, you shouldn't be here. And so I noticed that the same arguments were repeating themselves over and over and over again. So I started to explore it a little bit more. And I ended up, you know, I spent about a year doing a couple talks, doing keynotes about this at a few conferences. And I realized this was killing my soul.
Killing your soul, right.
It's, yeah, yeah, talking.
You had said, last year you wrote that Twitter had felt like a problematic teen. You struggled to co-parent with several million people.
Yes.
Did you ever think about just turning it off, or the comments at least?
Yeah.
I turned off my comments on Twitter first time since I started there in 2007, because I just didn't feel like being called a cunt anymore.
Right.
I just was like, no, I don't, I think that's what I'm not going to have happen to me today. Did you ever think about, and I just do, I get a lot of people, she doesn't even let you comment. I'm like, no, I don't.
No, so. because I'm tired of being called a cunt.
Yeah, like, yeah,
that's
exactly.
It.
Yeah, that's
no,
enough.
I mean, I think that, you know, I've written about this, to be a writer on Twitter, it was this double-edged sword. And I use past tense because I'm no longer on Twitter, right? Like, I effectively still have an account, but I'm rarely there.
Yeah, 'cause you don't want people to take it, yeah.
Exactly. But I didn't, you know, I didn't want to cut off one of my main sources of reaching my audience. You know, for a nonfiction writer, I had 140,000 followers, which was huge. And engagement was a huge part of it. And honestly, it wasn't something I even considered. Isn't that crazy? I never considered stopping the pipeline that allowed people to abuse me.
Right.
It's like it wasn't an option.
So it's changed your approach to social media. You just felt like it's too good in some ways to turn off, essentially.
I think that the model of social media is that we don't— you cannot utilize it effectively if you turn off those comments.
Right, right,
right. Right.
Because you have to know. Except now they've become so trolly. But the Pratelli piece isn't the only one that had trolls on your back. In 2021, you're back again. You reviewed a 27-course tasting menu at the Michelin-starred restaurant in Italy called Bros. The headline is Bros Lecce, We Eat at the Worst Michelin-starred Restaurant Ever. Explain, and please feel free to relive the quote, rancid ricotta.
Oh. Absolutely. I'm such a rascal, aren't I?
Yes,
I just get—
you're
I
a
just
very
get,
angry woman. I think you need to see what's
just
wrong.
Just chill. Maybe I'm hungry.
Yeah, maybe
it's
that.
Once again, I cause an international incident
with
an asshole chef who happens to be Italian. So we go to Italy, COVID restrictions.
Chef Floriano.
Floriano, yes. COVID restrictions have just lifted for Italy. We go— you know, we see people we didn't think we were going to see again. It was beautiful. And on our last night all together, we go to this restaurant. And part of the impetus for that is that one of the chefs was the youngest female Michelin-starred chef ever. So it is one of the only Michelin-starred restaurants in Lecce. And it turns out to be— I cannot impart to you what a sheer disaster of a meal this was. So it's 4 hours, roughly, virtually 400 calories, maybe, was served.
Yeah.
I was famished. And, like, I'm not a huge eater. I was so hungry. And my husband informed them of several allergy restrictions that he had, and they completely ignored them, to the point that at one point he had to take, you know, an antihistamine, and he's like, my lips are starting to swell. So I wrote, you know, I wrote about it in this semi, you know, in a humorous way, but it was also, you know, entirely factual account of what happened to us, what was served, what occurred. And once again,
it blew up. Five million visitors.
Technical term, bonkers viral.
Bonkers viral, which is a real thing.
Yep.
But then he wrote a response, Chef Floriano, basically saying that his food was art and you didn't get it. And he didn't even name you, just called you Mrs. X, X, X.
Yes, Miss Triple X. Yes.
Triple X, right. Okay. Yes. Talk about the response and what did you make of it?
Yeah, so he wrote a manifesto, which he insisted be published in full, which is usually what, you know, serial killers do. So that was interesting.
Right. Uh-huh.
So he posts it and the Today Show or Today.com publishes it in full. And I feel like my soul left my body. I was laughing so hard. It was absurd. It included three photos of a man on a horse. And it said that food is art. And sometimes art is not beautiful. And sometimes people just are too base and ignorant to understand art. Which is an absurd statement because food is actually far more complex than art, right?
Yeah,
food serves a specific purpose and it can't be poisonous. So the New York Times did coverage of the story.
Yeah.
And they interviewed me and they interviewed Floriano, but what resulted was this puff piece about the chef in which he said, and he said it across multiple publications in Italy as well, that I deserved to be punched. If I had behaved that way at another restaurant, I would have been thrown out. But one of the instances that came up was about rancid ricotta. And I was speaking to one of the servers, and he said, this is made with rancid ricotta. And I said, do you mean fermented? And he goes, no, rancido. And I'm like, oh, that's a phrase. All right. And so I wrote about that as well. And he was like, you just don't understand the cuisine of Puglia, you don't understand Italy. And I'm like, I speak the language. So
right.
It was all of these levels of attack. And again, it became the same way that we always attack women, right? You just don't understand. You're too ignorant. You're not familiar with the industry. You're an outsider. You deserve to be beaten. You're ugly and old, right?
This is over ricotta. Okay.
Over the meal.
Right.
And what was astonishing about that one is the New York Times reiterated these statements that he made. And so I'm seeing this legitimacy of all of these things, all of this hate in the paper of record.
And you were contacted by a woman who had worked at Rose who described a toxic work environment, which is not a fresh thing for the food industry.
No, not at all. So almost immediately after the first kind of story, after Floriano sent his response out and it was still kind of going viral, I was contacted by a woman who had worked for him. And there were also several allegations that had come up on Twitter. And she ended up telling me, you know, just situations that, you know, are incredibly toxic and abusive. And there were more allegations beyond that. At that point, I was like, look, I'm not a food journalist. I'm a food essayist, and I'm a part of this story. So ethically, I can't cover this.
Right.
I ended up passing it to several news outlets. And again, the one that picked it up was the New York Times. And it was my understanding that they were pursuing the story of abuse allegations. And they ended up dropping that story because they said that there was not enough essentially U.S. national interest in an Italian chef. But then they ended up putting him in the front section.
Right. So this is not uncommon. They're not, Mario Battaglia or Chef Floriano are not anomalies in the food industry.
No.
According to a Harvard study in 2018, more sexual harassment claims were filed in the restaurant industry than any other. 90% of women and 70% of men say they've experienced some form of sexual harassment while working there. I think a lot of people knew it was bad, but this bad. Why is that? Why is that? Is it just people file more claims or than other places? Or what do you attribute that to?
I think.
And by the way, it's both men and women harassing. It's a really, you've read so many different, and a lot of it's abuse, just plain old abuse.
I think that it is an incredibly toxic environment that for the most part is actually hidden to the public. Right, mm-hmm. We don't see what goes on in kitchens. We're sort of unaware. We see the byproduct of it. We see the food that comes out. And I think that we societally have celebrated and excused the sort of genius, abusive chef. And we've right. seen this with Marco Pierre White. We've seen this with Gordon Ramsay, who, you know, does commercials where he yells at people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so ingrained in our approach and how we view it that it's just gone under the radar for far too long.
And why do you think it's in that particular industry? Is there something about it?
I don't know. I mean, look, is it a male-dominated industry? Yes. Is it a high-pressure industry? Absolutely. Are there a lot of industries that are like that? Yeah. So why cooking becomes, or why the culinary world becomes this sort of conduit for it, I still haven't quite figured that out.
Could it be power discrepancies and high turnover, or because the power discrepancies is almost like the military, except
there is
with no military.
There is
right?
Well, that is what it was modeled after, right? The early
like the
kitchens
military.
Were modeled after it was militaristic structure, but they didn't quite have this level of abuse. So I do think that there are people who are looking for power and they find an ability to do that, and it becomes unchecked, and it becomes celebrated.
Celebrated, yeah. So Batali's Del Posto had 2 Michelin stars. Bros had 1 Michelin star. As a food writer, do you think a food guide like Michelin should take into account not just the food and service, but also the reputation of the restaurant, or is that not their job? They're just here for the food.
I mean, honestly, I obviously think so, because the reputation has to do with the experience that the customer has. If you're giving awards or recognition to restaurants or chefs that are behaving in this way, that's kind of a detriment to your own institution. And I think the James Beard Association, you know, we've seen them have a reckoning about this recently. You know, there's been several chefs who have been called out, who have been awarded the James Beard Award, and then have been accused of sexual harassment. Allegations have come out. So they said that they're doing more strident examination of their nominees. So yeah, I think absolutely you need to be accountable.
So
it's kind
Michelin
of absurd.
Has admitted it has a problem when it comes to diversity, which has been criticized by many people, including from you. Mm-hmm. Gerald Sombright was the first Black chef to make the list in the U.S., and that was 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Is it doing enough? What is the problem? It can't, you know, I was just giving a speech to students at my old high school, and I said, if you look at the numbers in tech, you'd think only straight white men were the only important, smart people in the universe, if you looked at it, and that cannot be true. It is not true, and it cannot be true. Why is that from your perspective in the food industry?
I mean, it's, you know, in the JBFA, it was the same thing. I believe Mashama Bailey was the first outstanding chef to receive an award in, it might have been 2020 or 2022. And it's clearly not a pipeline issue. You know, we have more women graduating culinary school than ever before. I think 54% of all graduates are women. I think what we are seeing is the people who are allowed to succeed are white men. Now, the research that I have found and the way that I have looked at it through the lens of the book, and I talk about this, is that men are allowed to be good chefs and we allow women to be good cooks.
Explain that difference.
So in a professional environment, in a lauded, celebrated kitchen environment, we allow men to excel, but we don't allow women to. And it's even in the descriptors of how women present food. And they did some analysis of this. They would present a dish, and when it was gender blind, the women were evaluated with higher ratings. When someone knew that the dish had been created by a woman, they evaluated it with a lower rating.
Yeah.
And yet, within the home, women do the majority of the cooking. So I
right.
think when that labor is invisible and free and uncompensated, we allow women to do it. So, I mean, misogyny is at the heart of it, right? And it always is.
One interesting deep dive in your book was some of the sexist practices affecting diners. You wrote about getting a menu without price as a ladies' menu. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you a very short story. There was a place called the Birdcage at Lord & Taylor's that had boys got desserts, double desserts on certain days. It was Boys' Day. And so I have two brothers, got two desserts and I got one on Boys' Day at the Birdcage.
Because you had to watch your figure?
No, I don't know, but it was, but because it was Boys' Day and when it's Girls' Day, you'll get it, but there was never a Girls' Day.
What the fuck?
I always went and they're like, oh, today's Boys' Day again. And I was like, when is it Girls' Day? Like, when do girls get
desserts? And it never happened.
Never happened. It sticks with me. I am a very old lady right now and I'm still furious about the Birdcage and Boys' Day and desserts. So talk about the ladies' menu. Because the boys can eat it, you know, the boys.
Yeah, that is some. So first, let's say that's some extreme bullshit.
I know. My brothers loved it. They're like, Boys' Day. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry. They still to this day say Boys' Days to me and I want to punch them. So anyway. So ladies' menu.
So the ladies' menu. So originally, restaurants were not for women. You would walk into a dining hall and it was, you know, populated entirely by white men, you know. I think I said it was like a GOP convention. And if you were a woman who was attending a dining hall, you would only be doing it in the company of a man. That was the only way. And so the assumption was men would pay. And largely because women could not have their own money.
Mm-hmm.
So you would be presented a menu with no prices. Now, there was a lawsuit in the early 1980s because a woman who was attending a lunch with her business partner and intending to pay to celebrate a deal that they had just closed received a menu without prices, and both she and her business partner walked out, and they ended up suing the restaurant, and that led to kind of the demise of the ladies' menu in the United States. You can still find it in two or three restaurants, but I've received it several times while traveling in Europe, primarily in Italy. I didn't realize what was happening when I received the menu. I thought there was a price somewhere and I had missed it. And it wasn't until my husband was commenting on the prices that I realized that his menu had prices and mine did not.
Right, right. There is a recent story about Sushi Naz, a Japanese restaurant in New York.
Yes.
Two Michelin stars that served only women in a group, smaller portions than men for a $700 omakase tasting menu. It's a very similar thing, correct?
Yeah, and I've gone places where I've noticed that I've received smaller portions. And I thought it was a bad luck of the draw. I was like, oh, I guess, you know, my piece happened to be smaller. And it never occurred to me. And so now I'm kind of more attuned to this now.
To the but sizes.
This is a common occurrence. And so receiving a menu without prices, besides just being disorienting, you know, assumes that you are not paying. And more than once, I have been the one paying.
So one of the things, besides being funny, is your reaction to your work have been divisive, as you said, not just online. People seem to either love you or hate you. Jennifer Reese from The Times gave your book, not a good review. It's written here, a mixed review, but I don't think it was mixed.
It's not a mixed review.
She said your quote, I had the same experience, it's fine. My wife gave me all my sources, in case you're interested.
Oh, I read it. I read it,
It's really great, because I met her 7 years after I started covering things. But, you know, I went back in a time machine, or went forward in a time machine. Anyway, she said you had a, quote, mastery of irony, profanity, stream of consciousness, indignation, but to swamp your writing with, quote, salty all caps asides and sarcasm. Mini diatribes. She accused you of ranting, I believe. Talk about this review, having just had a ridiculously sexist review written at me.
Yeah, so it came out 2 days before the book. So it came out on March 10th. The book came out on the 12th. And I think that we should also talk about the accompanying illustration, because that was the part where, my soul left my body. So it is a rendition of what appears to be my head. It looks like it's based off of my author photo. It has my exact same shade of lipstick. It's my decapitated head on a platter, and someone is eating it. So whether it's a cake Or it's
what food would you be, a cake? Or
I mean, I would like to think I would be a cake. Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
it's a picture of a woman eating the head of a woman. That's what's
yeah,
happening.
Yeah, and picture. the eyes have been gouged out, and there's
obviously
a part in the back that has been gouged out. Yeah. So it's a little, it's got some St. John the Baptist vibes.
So thoughts?
Yeah, so... So along with this is the review by Jennifer Reese, which is not a positive review. As she calls me loud, irrational, ravenous.
Right. So you're hungry.
Yes. She describes me as having an all eyes on me personality.
Oh, narcissistic. Yeah. Don't do that.
Yes. And then
oh, I've gotten that one.
Have you? Isn't it funny? Yeah. It's really funny as a memoirist.
You shouldn't. Well, I had one just recently. Don't, you shouldn't talk about your book so much. I'm like, I'm selling a book. Like you,
I'm really curious if a man has ever gotten that feedback.
I'm uncommonly confident, in case you're interested. Uncommonly confident.
You really shouldn't be. You really shouldn't be. Yeah. Have you considered have you considered smiling more?
Here's a quote.
You'd be so pretty.
You know what? I have not considered it. One of her overarching gripes, a rightful gripe, is how the way women blunt their anger and soften their voices in order to placate and please, but women can also soften their voices in order to persuade and illuminate. That's essentially telling you to smile. That's, I believe.
She told me to smile more. She also openly questions why my husband loves me.
Oh.
Yeah. And I want to put that one in context because that one feels very important. It is in a chapter where I'm talking about dealing with the after effects of growing up with domestic violence and witnessing that and learning to accept that you deserve love and how it's still sometimes beyond my comprehension that my husband loves me. And she questioned that. And I was like,
she didn't read very carefully.
I was like, did you read it closely? Like, I think you would actually, I think the reviewer would have benefited from reading my book, was how I felt after the review. And so as kind of an addendum to this, and I realize that most illustrators don't read the book.
Right.
But I do think it was quite an oversight, is that I talk about one of the threats that I receive is, you know, I talk about how I get hate mail about people wishing illnesses upon my eyes and my vagina, and they've gouged out my eyes. But I've also had brain surgery, and I talk about this in the book. And so to visualize or show any sort of, you know, specific trauma where my head is cracking open is some bad taste.
Yeah, I see why your soul left your body. So every week we get a question. This is perfect from an outside expert, someone I know. Have a listen to this one.
Hey, I'm Blair Braverman. I'm a dog sledder and author of the novel Small Game. I'm interested in the assumption that writing about female rage is quote-unquote therapeutic, which frames the hard work of writing about sexism as something an author does for herself rather than something difficult and risky that she's doing for other people. Now, obviously, if someone's negative about your work, that's one thing. But my big question is, do you ever get compliments from well-meaning people that reveal they totally don't get your work? And if so, what are those compliments?
A great question. You know Blair, she's fantastic.
That is a great question. I do think the bravery comment is a weird one. Have you gotten this?
Yes. Go ahead. You tell me. This is about you.
Yeah. It is strange when people are like, oh, you're so brave. It makes me very uncomfortable.
Why is
because
that?
It suggests that I have revealed something that perhaps other people would be afraid to reveal.
Mm-hmm.
And that perhaps I shouldn't have. It gives me pause because it suggests that bravery is required to talk about trauma or difficult things. And I don't necessarily know that it's true. I think that, well, I don't know. But I don't think bravery is the right word.
What about the framing of sexism that you do for yourself rather than for others?
I think that is interesting because I write through the lens of memoir, and it would be disingenuous to say that there is not a part of it that is not for me.
Mm-hmm.
However, to say that this is just me exploring and kind of dealing with and in a way really accepting and coming to terms with my own trauma and finding peace with it, I don't think that that is accurate. I think that there is something incredibly difficult with writing about all of these topics.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that I am doing some sort of great social service, but if I don't talk about this shit, I do think I'm going to explode. Is right. that fair? I don't know if that is like this peaceful therapy. I think it's mm-hmm. more just this like pressure valve.
You're telling the truth. How are you so confident? Is that unusual? I don't know.
I think it's more a pressure valve. I think that this is just preserving some degree of sanity for myself. And I have to say, I am always a little bit taken aback when people tell me they feel the same way. I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. I'm so thrilled.
There's a lot of commonality.
And I will say, I also have I have deep anxiety whenever I write something deeply personal. I have deep anxiety. I have a lot of vulnerability hangovers. When I turned in the draft of this book, I was just a nervous wreck. I wasn't sure if I wanted to talk about or reveal these things. But I also think that it's important to talk about the bullshit that we all deal with.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah.
100%. We'll be back in a minute. Support for this show comes from Ramp. Are you overwhelmed with managing your business expenses, vendor payments, and accounting? Is your finance software just not cutting it? Or maybe you're just looking to cut all that wasteful spending. Ramp could be a total game changer for you and your business. Ramp is the corporate card and spend management software designed to help you save time and put money back in your pocket. Ramp gives finance teams unprecedented control and insight into company spending. With Ramp, you're able to issue cards to every employee with limits and restrictions and automate expense reporting so you can stop wasting time at the end of every month. Plus, Ramp is easy to use. You can get started, issue virtual and physical cards, and start making payments in less than 15 minutes, whether you have 5 employees or 5,000. Not only that, but Ramp can save you money. They estimated that businesses that use Ramp save an average of 5% the first year. And now you can get $250 when you join Ramp. Just go to ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara, ramp.com/Kara. Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply. Support for On With Kara Swisher comes from Delete Me. Chances are you have some kind of online presence, but that doesn't mean your private information should be available for anyone to see, let alone sell. DeleteMe is a subscription service that wipes your personal info from hundreds of people's search databases on the web. DeleteMe finds and removes personal information sold by data brokers that you don't want online and makes sure it stays off. You can tell DeleteMe exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. It can even send you regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I really like DeleteMe. I was very surprised by how much data there was about me, including old addresses, phone numbers, everything else. And I use it to get rid of it on the web and all these people's search databases. You can take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. You can get 20% off your DeleteMe plan today when you go to joindeleteme.com/Kara and use the promo code Kara at checkout. Again, you can get 20% off by going to joindeleteme.com/Kara and enter the code Kara at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Kara, code Kara.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
So, speaking of bullshit we all deal with, let's talk more about this writing about rage. You write about the connection between anger and hunger in a chapter called Hanger Management, how you deal with both. What is the connection between anger and hunger?
Well, so I think that women are taught to suppress both.
Yeah.
Very much so. And I think that the only acceptable way that we are allowed to express any sort of rage is when we are hungry. And then we dismiss it and other people dismiss it. You know, you have these moments of sheer rage and then you're like, oh, I'm so sorry. I was just hungry. And it's not illegitimate because right. We're hungry.
Yeah, you went into a doctor who told you to eat when you're hungry and you were shocked.
Mm-hmm. I talked to two nutritionists for the book and they both were, they were very mm-hmm. positive. They had wonderful relationships with food. Mm-hmm. Both of them did work with a lot of individuals who were recovering from eating disorders and who were dealing with very difficult, complex relationships mm-hmm. with food. And one of them said to me, you know, I was like, I don't know how to feel fuller longer, because that's what we're taught all the time. Like, this meal will keep you fuller longer. And she was like, why don't you just eat again?
Right.
And I was like, that's very obvious.
Yeah.
Why didn't that occur to me?
Yeah. Yeah. I say that to a lot of my women friends. I'm like, they're like, oh, I'm really hungry. I said, you should eat. And they're like, what? Like, huh?
Yeah.
Like, that's not the choice. Which brings us to the core topic of the book, how being a food writer has impacted your relationship to food and your body mm-hmm. image and how it impacts us all. Mm-hmm. This is a key part of this book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, to exist as a woman in a body in the world, there is no way to not have someone comment on what you eat constantly. And I see it from every single angle, even when somebody's like, oh, do you think that's healthy? Well, what do you mean by that? And what does it matter? Is it what you're craving? Does it nourish you? Do you need food right now? Then eat it. Is it going to satisfy you? Then do it. But it's so loaded, right? What we eat is so loaded and it's so tied to our bodies and how we view ourselves and how other people view us. And then there's this huge issue of fatness, right? Which is a word we can barely say, but it's this idea of don't get fat, whatever you do, as though it's a moral failing for your body to have fat on it.
I'm just curious then, I don't know if you saw Oprah's ABC special on weight loss drugs. Weight Watchers is going to be including Wegovy and Zepbound in their program. Just this idea of medicating obesity will change our relationship to food because it also suppresses our taste for food, right? It strips people of the desire to eat. It of course, also reinforces thinness, mm-hmm. possible health, but thinness. And some of it, people are like, good, like, let's get rid of the diabetic industrial complex, right? Obviously, there's going to be a health divide, but 40% of U.S. adults had obesity in 2018. It's a huge health problem. I'd just love to know your thoughts on this, because it's a complex topic. There's all kinds of ways to hit at it, in that it's okay to have weight. On the other hand, some of it's very bad for your health. How do you look at it? And also, stripping the desire to eat is really an interesting question. Food is something very beautiful, the enjoyment of food, which it removes completely.
It is. And there's another element here too, right? Which is there are people who are using this who are not using it for medical reasons, right? They are
right.
They're not obese.
Yeah.
And, you know, someone called this the Ozempic Oscars.
Right.
Because everyone was dangerously thin. Mm-hmm. And there were actors who have always been, you know, I refer to them as average weight, right? Like,
right. You
look like somebody I would see at the store. And they all of a sudden are now, you know, rail thin. And part of that is because they are able to, you know, I think Ozempic And I'm using that as a generic term. I know there's a bunch of them, but I believe they cost $1,500 a month.
Yeah, they will go down in price eventually. But how do you look at this idea of, you know, all this, the relation between women and food and weight and food and weight and women is so, it has become such a thing. And yet there's also love your body, love your, and you should. Like it's right. A complex issue.
And we're getting so many conflicting messages, right? And we I have to say the love your body thing, that's new. Mm-hmm. That's new. That's not really something I heard.
No, neither. Me neither.
Right. I think that this is something that the new generations are getting. At the same time that they're being told this drug will make you lose weight. I will say I'm wary because, you know, these are very new. I do think that there is a benefit, you know, to be evaluated here if you have severe health issues that are being caused by or exacerbated by weight and there is no other alternative for you. I understand that. I also know people who are on these drugs and a few of them have told me they have never felt sicker in their entire lives. And a lot of them are, you know, unable to eat because of the sheer nausea. I talked to someone in my life and they said, I can barely brush my teeth because putting the toothbrush in my mouth makes me want to throw up.
What happens when we don't love food, right? Because you love food, obviously.
I do. It's so funny, too, when people say that because, you know, 43 years of being a woman in the world, I bristle. I still react. I'm like, well, wait, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. What are you saying? What are you
you're
saying
fat.
When you tell
I'm
me I
fat.
Love? Are you? And if you are... And if you are, that automatically means it's bad, right? Yeah. It automatically means it's bad if I'm fat. That's how that works. And it is such a complex thing because, like, I have a great relationship with food. And I realize that it's a privilege for me to say that because, you know, I'm walking around in, like, a size 6, size 8. You know, that's my body, right? I'm a relatively small woman in a body in the world. And so for me to be able to say I like food, I love these things, for me to be able to make cracks about eating cake, that's born of privilege.
Sure. But you hesitate, just like you
I
hesitate
do.
Saying.
Yeah.
Or,
oh, you know. I mean, shit, misogyny and years of anti-fatness is a hell of a drug.
A hell of a drug.
And it is deep in us, right? It is deep ingrained in you. And I think one of the things that we have done societally is we have confused fatness universally with being unhealthy. Now, sometimes it's true. Being very thin is also unhealthy. So I worry that these weight loss drugs are conflating that message even more.
Yeah.
Why do we associate thinness with beauty and health? This is the longest period in society, because it's always gone back and forth, but this is the longest period in society where we have embraced, you know, very, very thin bodies.
100%. I have two more questions. What do you think the food trend of the year will be? What are you seeing out there?
You know, I'm seeing people really going back to a lot of deeply personal and emotional recipes. So, mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot of people who are making food that they have an emotional tie to. So it's their grandmother's recipe, it's their family recipes, and I see them doing more elaborate spins on those. Like, okay, grandma did this. I wanna try and recreate it, but I wanna add something to it. So I'm seeing that, but that has been true for a while. I'll tell you what I really want to continue seeing, mm-hmm. which is I really just want people to eat.
Yeah.
God, I just want them to eat. I'm seeing people focus on the nutrition of food, absent of calories and absent of morality. So I'm seeing a lot less, this is naughty, this is for cheat day. I'm seeing a lot less of that bullshit. And I'm seeing people say things like, I need to get more protein because I'm a woman in this age. So right. that's what I'm hoping will continue as a food trend, really that focus on health.
So my last question right now, what is your favorite food?
I just got back from Italy.
You weren't with Chef Floriano, I assume.
I was not. I was very far. I was very far from Chef Floriano. And we were in Lazio, which is, you know, where Rome is. So there was a lot of carbonara, which is like my favorite thing. But there was also, I don't know what it was, there was truffle everything. And I know truffle is overdone. I don't care. I don't care if it makes me basic.
It's all right.
I do not care. I was just having some really simple pastas with shaved truffles, and it was fantastic. And because it was Europe and not America, it was like 15 euros and not 98. Mm-hmm. And so that was fantastic.
Cheap truffles.
Cheap truffles. Oh, yeah.
Cheap truffles.
Cheap truffles.
All right, Geraldine, this is an amazing book. I recommend everyone read it. It'll make you laugh. It is not a rant. It is just a lovely book. It's called If You Can't Take the Heat, Tales of Food, Feminism, and Fury. You are not furious. You are hysterical. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
On with Kara Swisher is produced by Naeem Araza, Christian Castro-Russell, Kateri Yoakum, Megan Burney, and Sheena Ozaki. Special thanks to Mary Mathis, Kate Gallagher, and Andrea Lopez-Cruzado. Our engineers are Fernando Aruda and Rick Kwan. And our theme music is by Trackademics. If you're already following the show, you get Cheap Truffles. If not, you get Mario Batali's Pizza Cinnamon Buns. Go wherever you listen to podcasts, search for On with Kara Swisher and hit follow. Thanks for listening to On with Kara Swisher from New York Magazine, the Vox Media Podcast Network, and us. You can subscribe to the magazine at nymag.com/pod. We'll be back on Thursday with more.